I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Pay inequity is a reality in the United States. 2016 data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows the median weekly earnings for women were 82% of the median weekly earnings for men, even though women accounted for 44% of full-time wage and salary workers. Data from a 2015 Economic Policy Institute report finds women earn less than men at every education level. Pay inequity isn't just a woman's issue. It has broad implications for economic security for families and the overall health of our economy. Today, we're discussing pay inequity and other barriers to economic stability and security for families. We'll also discuss policies and programs with the potential to break down those barriers. Joining us from our studio at WGBH in Boston is State Treasurer Deb Goldberg. Welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Mindy. It's good to be here.
Here in Woods Hole with us is Valerie Bassett. She's Executive Director of the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And from her office in Washington, D.C., Erin Currier, Director of the Financial Security and Mobility Project at the Pew Charitable Trust. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we know pay inequity is one of the barriers to women and families attaining economic security. So what do we mean by economic security? And Treasurer Goldberg, let's start with you.
Well, this was always a huge issue to me because it was very clear to me when I became treasurer that when you have such a large part of the population that does not earn what they should, it has incredible ramifications from a very young age all the way through to being seniors. So, for example, you take a married couple and you have two people, they get out of with the same education, including a Harvard MBA, they have the same debt. And yet the woman is earning less money and less able to pay down her debt as rapidly as the male. But if they're married, it has a huge impact on their whole family, on their ability to spend money, buy a home, take care of their children. And that inequity just rolls forward all the way through retirement and retirement savings and the cost for women as they age, because they do live longer. And so it impacts our entire economy, not just in Massachusetts, but in the entire country. And so pay inequity hurts everyone, even though a lot of people don't realize it.
Erin, the Pew Charitable Trust launched a security and mobility project, and we're going to talk about some of your findings in a little bit. But how does Pew define economic security?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it's an important one because there isn't actually a uniform definition of economic security that everyone looks to. I think broadly, the way we think about it is families having enough income to cover all of their expenses and maybe have a little bit left over that they can put into savings or otherwise use to acquire wealth. One of the points I would underscore is that often when we think about economic security, we look to metrics of income or wages, and those are really important, but they're only one piece of the balance sheet for families. If families also have rising expenses that don't keep up with income, or if they have high debt, or if they just don't have a good matchup between their income and their expenses such that they don't have any savings, they can't weather financial shocks. They can't deal with financial emergencies, and so income alone becomes a sort of important piece, but is only one small piece of the overall puzzle when we think about economic security.
Well, we mentioned women earn less than men at every education level. So what are some of the reasons women are less economically secure than their male counterparts?
I think it really goes back to the fact that our economy is not based on women working, and also undervalues the work that women traditionally do. So there are really there's a snowballing effect of barriers. So we have when women something called the motherhood penalty and then the fatherhood bonus, again based on this traditional underpinning that I think affects people at the unconscious level and used to be much more conscious, thinking that a man would be the breadwinner and need more money every time there was a child, and a woman would essentially leave the workforce. So I think that's a factor. You know, every time a woman has a child, she's penalized economically. We know that conscious and unconscious bias play a factor in salaries and in promotions and hiring. We know that sexual harassment plays a factor in limiting, you know, women might avoid certain people at work, a boss, miss a promotion. And we know that the issues around the jobs that women choose because of their caretaking roles has an effect.
Yeah. Sexual harassment has been a workplace significant problem and has major implications for women's economic security. We know that many women don't disclose harassment for fear of retaliation, and that can be in the form of job loss or, as you mentioned, denials of promotions or raises. Treasurer Goldberg, to what extent do you think workplace sexual harassment plays in the role in women being less economically secure than men?
Well, I can only speculate on that, but when we look at wage negotiation, for example, and what is involved in that, we see that women will often have to ask their boss, and in this world, the boss is often a man. That puts them in, A, an uncomfortable position, generally speaking, and B, in a vulnerable position. So even in the situation where there is no sexual harassment, there is this sense of power between the boss and the person asking for the wage increase or for a fair pay. We've done studies where we see that there are pink job environments and blue job environments. And one of the things that we've tried to teach through our downloadable toolkit for businesses is how to identify what's going on in your own organization and see the pink versus blue and note that the pink are typically paid less. And so on our website, equalpayma.com, there is that toolkit for businesses. And I want to thank Pew because I'm always citing your research, McKinsey's and State Street's, that says that businesses that change this dynamic, that empower women, that pay them what they're worth, who have them in upper levels of management and on their boards, are more profitable. So this is a business imperative for everyone. I keep on tying these issues back to the general health of our economy because it is factually based. This is not just a social good. Of course it's a social good, but it's an economic good for our state and our country.
Erin, do you want to chime in?
I do. I completely agree with that sentiment. I think what you're getting at is the fact that we have undergone a significant shift over the last generation, especially with regard to women's labor force participation. Women are now earning a significant portion of their family's income, and that is true whether they're in couples or on their own. And when you don't pay women equitably, you're not only harming them and their own economic security, but you're also holding back the economic potential for families broadly and for the country as a whole. One of the things that our research has shown is that the labor market, especially as it relates to benefits, really doesn't reflect the number of women and families, two-parent families, that are now in the labor market. And so it doesn't allow for people, for families broadly, to make good decisions about who can take some time out of the labor market when a child is born or when a family member is ill. You know, we have these benefits in place for certain occupations or for certain parts of the labor market, but they are not universal. And so that means that families, especially at the middle and below, often don't have access to the kind of pay and benefit that allow them to be economically secure and eventually to be upwardly mobile.
Well,
Mindy, can I just sort of
put something in there?
Mm-hmm. So this is exactly what we've done internally. I have 800 employees at the treasurer's office. We did an audit, a wage audit. We looked at job classifications in terms of pink and blue. But what we also did is we instituted, and this is sort of unheard of in government, 12 weeks paid parental leave for everyone at every level and flex time. Well, I've got to tell you, 55% of my total workforce is now women. Our diversity levels are the highest in state government. And it's because people know that they're going to get a job, that they're paid what they're worth, that they're going to have supportive HR policies. And you see, the thrust of our entire operation is that it starts at HR so that a woman, when they do come in to ask for a raise, is not feeling intimidated, but it is our duty as HR professionals and leaders of an organization to ensure that people are paid equally because we recognize the connection between economic stability in our state. So that's what we try to teach businesses, that this is beneficial to them. We've had virtually no turnover, and the cost of turnover is enormous.
Right. Well, I want to underscore the importance of both the paid family and medical leave that we're talking about, and in particular for women of color and low-income women, and a dynamic that we see in Massachusetts that I think is little known, where we have a very high percentage of low-income families who are headed by women. Mm-hmm. And in fact, something people are always surprised when I say, share this, in a study from the Working Poor Families Project a few years ago, Massachusetts is actually has the fifth highest percentage of low-income households headed by women in the country. Mm-hmm. We're tied with Mississippi.
Wow.
And I think, you know, in a way, there's a positive side. We have a lot of benefits and social services here, but there's a very negative side as well in terms of what the challenges those families face are. We know that women of color and low-income women are less likely to have the kind of policies that Treasurer Goldberg is pioneering and are so critical. So we really need to look at making those widespread, especially thinking about economic and racial disparities and inequities.
A 2015 data from the Economic Policy Institute finds the majority of workers in the largest low-wage occupations are women. The lowest-wage occupations, child care workers, home health aides, maids, housekeepers, personal care aides, and wait staff. So why do we find women in these positions? Do we know about the reasons that these are low-wage occupations? Is it because we don't value that work or because women gravitate to those jobs? Is it a combination of both? Who wants to chime in?
I'm happy, this is Val, to jump in. I would love reinforcement, but I think certainly that, as I mentioned before, caretaking roles have traditionally been, you know, the sort of unpaid work that women have done, and the paid part of it as well. And so I think both it's something, there's a socialized women choosing that factor, and then there's a factor that it's been so unpaid and underpaid for so long that it does not have a dollar value. It's the kind of thing people say, oh, it's priceless, mm-hmm. but then don't really value in the economy. I also think those can be fields that are not organized, that are not unionized, that are not haven't yet had some of the bargaining power that other lower wage fields in the past have had. So we're really behind.
I want to mention something that I think is very starkly shocking, is that nursing has typically been a woman's field, and as men have come into nursing, the statistics now show that there's an increasing wage gap between male nurses and female nurses. We were stunned in our office when we saw that last year.
Yeah. Now, how do women compare to men in access to higher education, career training? You know, we're talking about, you know, asking for a wage that is fair, or, you know, for positions. But are we trained? I mean, do we have the same opportunities for training as men do?
Well, one of the things that we did in Greater New Bedford is partner with UMass Dartmouth's Public Policy Institute and do an analysis around the wage and educational gap in the region. And so, you know, we definitely saw a clear wage gap, which is tracks a little worse in New Bedford and Fall River than the rest of the state because they're more economically depressed and lag behind in other indicators. But I think the thing we also saw was looking at the regional Voc Tech School, looking at Bristol Community College, and looking at UMass Dartmouth about what majors, what areas of focus girls and boys choose, and then what the average wages of those are. And it's definitely starting in high school, you know, and I think a lot of the literature shows that girls tend to have different expectations and lower expectations in terms of math and science and leadership beginning in middle school. You know, I think there's a huge socialization factor there, and as well as how our educational system is structured, what happens with guidance counselors, what happens with professors who say, well, you know, you could do this and this instead of that because the math is too hard, et cetera. Mm. So I think there are a lot of forces at work, and definitely that tracking is happening. And I also want to add to the negotiation piece, I think there are different ways that girls are socialized to negotiate in terms of wage negotiation than boys. That being said, I have been quite interested in the research that shows that when women are negotiating on behalf of someone else, they can negotiate a high salary or a benefit just fine. Mm-hmm. It is really, it's not the skill in itself. It's something around when it's ourselves as a direct negotiation with someone.
Right.
One of the things I want to mention, sorry.
Go ahead. Treasurer Goldberg, we'll go with you and then Aaron.
Because of the recognition of that, we've developed some targeted mentorship programs going all the way down to sixth grade, because we actually see girls wanting to go into robotics labs, wanting to do math and science, and then finding some isolation in middle school, high school, and pressure to switch to dance club away from robotics. So we focused on mentorship programs in that level, all the way up to we have a Women in Finance Fellowship. And the reason being, particularly in Massachusetts, our financial services are a huge part of that STEM scenario. Math is financial services. And I've gone all the way up to speaking in New York to women in alternative finance, the most high-powered women you can think of, and hearing their stories about their being shifted once they have a child. And they're working 24/7, 7 days a week. But if they don't come into the office on Friday, they're beginning to get cut out of the deals, even though they're working from home. So we do have a cultural issue, and what we need to do is mentor from the youngest girls all the way through professional women to help them stay that track. And it's things that we have focused on in our office.
Yeah. Aaron?
I wanted to make a high-level point about women's educational attainment and just to sort of point out that since 1996, young women who are ages 25 to 29 have had higher college attainment rates than men of the same age. So we see women really responding to the need for higher education and earning degrees at a higher rate than men. But unfortunately, as we have been talking in this conversation, it's also clear that women aren't necessarily earning the same sort of wage bump from that college attainment as our men. And in particular, if you compare women today, working age women in their 40s, let's say, to their own mothers, they're making significantly more money than their mothers did. They're working many more hours per week. They're earning a higher hourly wage. But if you compare them to their fathers, they are not making more than their fathers did 30 years ago at every rung of the wage ladder. Women today still make less than men did 3 decades ago.
We were talking about pay inequity and other barriers to economic stability and security for families. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about pay inequity and other barriers to economic stability and security for families with State Treasurer Deb Goldberg, Valerie Bassett, Executive Director of the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts, and Aaron Currier, Director of the Financial Security and Mobility Project at the Pew Charitable Trust. Treasurer Goldberg, how do Massachusetts women compare with other states in terms of wage equality and economic security?
Well, what's really interesting is Massachusetts women are very highly educated. And yet we are 82 cents on the dollar. And that includes the most educated, the most highly paid women throughout the state. And so we're not there. Even here in Massachusetts, in progressive Massachusetts, we're just not there. And again, that is why we are doing in my office the work that we're doing, outreaching in so many different areas and touching upon those and delivering programs and setting up mentorships, because we really feel that we need to push the envelope and make sure that businesses know how to identify the issues that evolve within their organizations and understand that they will be more innovative, more creative, and more profitable if they actually do this. Mm-hmm. And so I think that connecting those dots and getting folks on board, we're doing it, we're moving it along, but it's not moving fast enough. Because long term, women aren't having the resources to take care of their families and they are not being able to save to help their kids go through school or themselves live a decent retirement and at the end of their work cycle.
As we look at the wage gap for women overall, I think it's really important to break it down by race and ethnicity as well, because there are profound, even deeper inequities where African-American women are earning about 66 cents on the white male dollar, and Latinas even less, you know, in the 55-ish cents on the white male dollar as well. So again, looking at how racial inequity overlaps with sexism and in terms of the barriers, and I know Pew Research bears this out in terms of what we see for family and women's economic security and stability for families of color. So I think when we think about the problem and solutions, it's important to keep that in mind.
Yeah. Erin Pugh launched a security and mobility project. Tell us more about the project and the goals.
Sure. So we began thinking about family economic opportunity probably a decade ago, and we're really focused on the health and status of the American dream. So we were thinking about economic mobility broadly. How do people move up and down the economic ladder over their lifetimes and across generations? Who is able to move up from the bottom, and what factors drive that upward mobility or downward mobility? And what we discovered is that a whole lot of things matter, right? You can, social capital matters, human capital, educational attainment, things like that matter. But we also can see very clearly that financial capital matters. And that brought us down to a more kitchen table issue of family economic security, thinking about income and expenses and wealth and savings and how all of these drivers interact to create opportunities for family or not. And what we can see is that a family's day-to-day situation, their month-to-month, their year-to-year finances, have a direct role in how economically mobile they will be over time.
One finding is that people prefer economic stability to economic mobility. Are you finding that Americans believe economic mobility is not as attainable as it used to be?
Well, it's a really interesting question. We have been doing, you know, focus groups and survey work back since 2009. And even then, you know, and that was right in the middle of the Great Recession, there was a feeling that families were really just interested in sleeping well at night. You know, if we ask them to define the American dream, they point to things like home ownership, having a college degree, their children being better off than them. But at the end of the day, to sort of draw a picture of what that looks like, family after family after family is describing being able to pay all of their bills at the same time and have a little bit left over, you know, just being able to sort of make it. They weren't describing being middle class or even being wealthy. That's not the definition that Americans were putting forward. The 92% number is really powerful and really important, because it's hard to get 92% on pretty much any question, right? And I think that that speaks to the fact that when individuals are thinking about what do they believe economic success looks like, it's much more about stability, about sleeping well at night. Certainly that doesn't preclude them from wanting to also move up, but I think in terms of relative importance, their priority is around just making it day to day.
So, and how do families handle emergency issues that require money, like, you know, unexpected car repair, illness, or sudden job loss?
Right. Well, they're cobbling together things as much as they can. So as we look across the entire income distribution, and I think this financial vulnerability goes up much farther than most people realize, what we can see is that a lot of American families are grappling with a couple of really difficult challenges when it comes to their money. So the first, as we've already talked about, is general sort of wage stagnation. Over the last several decades, we just haven't seen significant increases in wages for the typical American family. At the same time, we have seen increases in expenses. And so families just have less money at the end of the day after they pay for their core needs, their shelter, their food, their transportation. We can also see a huge amount of income volatility, where income is just not steady paycheck to paycheck for a lot of families. And so then they have a mismatch between their income and their expenses. And that mismatch can result in a lack of savings. Many families are experiencing an unplanned expense. This is everything from your car needing a new tire to the water heater breaking, right? There are just things that happen in life that we know eventually are going to happen, but we don't plan for the immediate moment when they do happen. Families are forced to rely on all kinds of sources to support themselves through that. They might have savings, although very few do. They might be able to put some of that expense on a credit card, although again, that requires access to credit, which not all families have. They might rely on family and friends. Some families tell us that they even have to sell something. Now, that's a little bit more extreme, but I think it just sort of goes to show that there is a huge diversity of experience happening here, and a lot of families report material hardship after having experienced a financial shock that can take them months to recover from.
Yeah. So what are some of the barriers to savings that we can address?
Well, you know, I think it's a complicated question, and there's no shortage of people really trying to think about and have been trying to think about how to make savings more fun for people, how to make it easier, how to offer products that just seem to speak to people's needs. But one thing that I would point to that I think holds a lot of promise is automaticity. You know, families who, for example, have access to a retirement plan at work where they make a decision one time and then the money is just quietly siphoned off from their paycheck into that retirement account show significantly more savings than families who have to make that decision over and over and over again to pull a piece out of their money, you know, something out of their income in order to put it into savings. Mm. If we could be doing something similar with savings, really pushing for automaticity, especially even through workplaces, I think you'd see a significant increase in the amount of emergency savings that families have because they wouldn't have to be thinking about it and consciously making the decision. They make the decision once and it's happening in the background and then they have a small nest egg that they can use in emergencies.
Yeah. Anybody else have thoughts on that? Val?
Well, yes, I want to mention that that's exactly the strategy that we have with the retirement plan for nonprofits of 20 people and below. We just actually received an award for it because it doesn't exist in the United States, and Massachusetts, through my office, is the first to do it. We're creating a low-cost 401k for nonprofits. Now, nonprofits are a large part of our economy here in Massachusetts, and women disproportionately work in nonprofits. And so we're creating a retirement savings plan. It's up and running, and it is at a much lower cost structure, which is far more appealing to a nonprofit that typically cannot afford to offer this to their employees. And so we've done that, and we've done with our college savings plan, which we're piloting in several cities throughout the state. What we're doing is it's an unusual 529 college savings plan in that we give a seeded account to kindergartners, and their families get services wrapped around them with talking about banking and retirement and saving. So we're doing financial literacy services through this seeded account, which gives us access to the total families. When you speak of people of color and people who are from different cultures, whether they're Latino or whether they're from Eastern Europe, we're doing these programs in multiple languages and working with culturally sensitive partners who are their churches, who are their community centers, who understand specific issues that are inherent to the cultures that they come from around banking and savings. Do you know that there are lots and lots of cultures that have a complete fear of banks? Mm. So this is something that we have to break through, and we're getting to it at the very, very grassroots level.
I would add that I think to echo the treasurer's point about financial literacy, we need structural changes and tools to easily and automatically save in, as Aaron said. And we need financial literacy starting from a young age with a particular focus on girls. And women need to talk to each other and mentor younger women in talking about money and savings. And then in the both educational and social profit sector, programs that serve women and families really should be incorporating asset building into the services. We incubate a program called the LifeWork Project for low-income women at Bristol Community College and have a savings match and an individual development account we jointly own, and the women can earn incentives for achieving goals. So learning to save, learning to use a bank is part of the program. I think that should be much more widespread. Mm.
Changes to the Affordable Care Act by the Trump administration and the tax overhaul legislation making its way through Congress have created a lot of uncertainty. How does uncertainty or instability future expenses impact low to moderate income families?
I'm happy to jump in on that. This tax bill is going to very much hurt lower income and middle income families here in Massachusetts. I think student debt is a perfect example. When you saw gas prices decline, you did not see increased spending in Massachusetts. The reason is that the extra income was going toward paying down debt. Now, for example, just citing one issue, which is the student debt deduction, that is eliminated in this tax bill. Then, if we don't have the mandate anymore, we're going to have a lot of people opting out of purchasing health insurance, and you want to talk about not being prepared for a catastrophe. That's a catastrophe for a young person that could absolutely bankrupt them and put them, quote unquote, out of business for a long time. One of the things that Valerie was talking about, and I want to call attention to, is that another website, myfinanciallifema.org, which is a financial literacy website where we have programs to look at that go from the youngest kid right through to seniors, and we executed this website because we wanted to be able to meet people where they had time to even look at it, whether it's 2 a.m. And so this was something that came out of my financial literacy task force, and it's something that is available to folks. The other thing I want to encourage people out in local communities to do, we have been able to fund with the Division of Banks credit for life fairs for high schoolers. And high schoolers are at a very, very critical time. We've reached, by the end of this semester, we will have reached 29,000 kids in Massachusetts in just the last 2 years, having them live a life. And they start off the day with a job and a salary. And I had one kid from Haverhill who said to me, I was given this job and my salary was $125,000 and I was rich. So immediately the young man went out and bought the biggest iPhone. Today it would be the 10. I think back then it was the 6, and adopted a pet, and he bought a car, and he decided he didn't need roommates for his apartment. And by noontime he was at the credit counselors. The pet got sick, and the pet needed these huge veterinary bills. Well, that was what disrupted him in his day in the life. But this program is incredibly enlightening for these kids at a time before they're selecting the college they're going to go to. Because another young woman told me, your parents said, don't worry about what college you choose. You'll just take the loans. Well, she said, I realize I should not just take the loans. These are life-changing programs, and we're getting them at these kids at a very important time.
We're talking about pay inequity and other barriers to economic stability and security for families, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about pay inequity and other barriers to economic stability and security for families with State Treasurer Deb Goldberg, Valerie Bassett, Executive Director of the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts, and Aaron Currier, Director of the Financial Security and Mobility Project at the Pew Charitable Trust. Data from the Economic Policy Institute published in 2015 shows wage stagnation for all workers, men and women, since 1990, despite significant increases in productivity. Aaron, does this correlate with what you are hearing from participants in your study?
It does. In fact, we have done similar research where we look at large government data sets that track these things over time, and we can see that same sort of earnings stagnation that has happened. Now, income, family income, has risen a little bit over the same period, and that's largely because of women's entrance into the labor market. Family income can now be supported by two earners in many cases instead of just one. And so when you look at family gains over time, it's usually because of that, because of women's entrance into the labor market. As I said earlier, though, I think it's really important to think about that wage stagnation in light of or in combination with all these other trends that are happening at the same time, which is expenses continuing to rise, especially for core needs, savings being basically flat or non-existent, income volatility affecting families across the income distribution, and then that mismatch between income and expenses, which really threatens family financial security, even if there are a little bit of savings in a household.
Mm. There's been a lot of debate about the effectiveness of an increase in the minimum wage. The Economic Policy Institute believes it would create more economic stability and bring wages in line with productivity, while others argue it would hurt small businesses and stifle growth. So what are your thoughts on the importance of an increase in the minimum wage for economic security?
I can speak to that because at the Women's Fund, we've had a two-year planning process that's helped us develop what we call the Economic Blueprint for Women. And it looks at recommendations really for some programs, but also really systems change and policies in several areas, including workplace benefits equity. Workplace benefits and wages and conditions equity. And so in that area, we looked at a few specific things that could make a difference for women, including implementing paid family and medical leave and increasing the minimum wage. And as you noted earlier, Mindy, it's disproportionately women who are earning a minimum wage. A minimum wage is sort of a placeholder for our least valued jobs. Unfortunately, a lot of those are traditionally held by women, and because of a lot of barriers that we talked about earlier, those maybe women choosing those jobs because they don't have access to other jobs. So I think it is a critical change. I don't think in and itself will solve the problem. I think we've seen in other research around increasing the minimum wage is that it is an adaptation for small businesses in particular, but it is not a killer.
Mm. Anybody else want to chime in?
I would say that the places where we should be paying attention to this law are about another piece that the Economic Policy Institute points out, which is that a large portion of people who would benefit are women. And the data in terms of places that have increased the minimum wage to date is mixed, certainly, and I think speaks to the necessity of a rollout that is planned and very methodical. But there's no question that if you are improving an element of families' balance sheets, like their wages, you're going to be increasing family economic security.
And what I always try to say to businesses are, you want your customers to have more resources to spend in your stores. Well, if everyone begins paying people what they're worth, we're going to have more robust customer base. Mm. And so we're talking about economic development and economic growth in general if we begin putting all of these policies into place. And so it may look like on the expense line that giving someone a minimum wage is a greater expense, but it results in long-term better profits for everybody.
Well, the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts convened this task force on pathways for women earning a livable wage. Tell us more about what the task force found and some of the ways that you're hoping to address some of the barriers. You mentioned some of them, but there are others.
Yes, there are. And for us, this was really a learning from the program I mentioned earlier, the LifeWork Project, which is really successful in helping women get on a path to a living wage. But there were a lot of barriers they faced that the program couldn't solve. They couldn't access childcare. they were losing their cash assistance public benefit before they were finished their education. They, you know, had a series of problems. Transportation, you know, walking 5 miles a day to try to get to school and work and the kids to daycare. So we realized we needed a deeper look at bigger solutions that could help more women and make really lasting change. So the group met for 9 months and came up with recommendations. And this was a cross-sector group of about 40 regional leaders and said, we need to make change in these key six areas. One, and this across the board, childcare is a huge barrier for women being getting an education or training, as well as fully engaged in the workforce. And so access to free and affordable childcare is the top and number one on the list. The others aren't in order of priority, but that was really cross-country cutting. The second is equity in workplace and benefits, everything from freedom from sexual harassment to implementing policies we were just discussing and having equal pay. The third is really looking at education and training so that we take this more systemic look at our educational and training systems and programs and make sure they are directing girls to living wage choices, including for the financial literacy to understand what that means. The next category is really improving women's health and safety and well-being, freedom from domestic violence and sexual assault, mental health. And then we said we need strong public programs and programs that provide safety nets and stepping stones. So safety nets, whether it be public housing and benefits that allow low-income women some stability. And there should be stepping stones as well, so programs and resources that help build assets, create some savings, and to move upward. And finally, we said in order to make this happen, we need more women in leadership. And so we are supporting increasing girls and women's participation in civic and political leadership.
Yeah. And how do we get more women into civic leadership and political leadership positions?
Well, let me give examples as to why this is critical. I came into the pension fund as its chair of its board and saw that we didn't vote for the 9,000 company board of directors if they didn't have one woman or one person of color. And I kind of looked at everybody because I cut to the chase and I went, one and done? We now do not vote for boards that don't have 30% women and people of color. That to me is a significant difference, and it's something that maybe wouldn't have happened if I wasn't there. Additionally, we've created an overboarding proxy voting guideline because what happens is these boards end up with a whole group of guys who play golf. I know a guy. I play golf with him. And so what we're saying is that you can't sit on too many boards together, guys. And this overboarding policy we see creates greater and greater openings where companies then have to go out and find women and people of color to put on their boards. So that's at the very upper levels. But what we do see is that women also, before they'll go to work at an organization, look to see whether or not there is a cohort. When you have women leadership in both the board level and potentially in the C-suite, there is a tendency to then know that companies are going to welcome you, particularly if you have things like paid parental leave, flex time, and things that support families. So we did all that internally, which resulted in our great numbers and why people apply for jobs at the treasurer's office because they know it's the real deal and they have a pathway. Well, that is what women leadership does. It identifies a problem, it identifies a solution, and willing to stay the road to that success because we know it also makes for better organizations. Again, I can't thank Pew and McKinsey and State Street enough because when I'm challenged publicly and I have these discussions, I've taken them nationally. I have become an officer of the National Association of State Treasurers in order to convince people in Arkansas, in Oklahoma, in Tennessee that these are good business decisions. So on the other hand, it isn't easy to mentor young women in politics, and organizations like Emerge have done a phenomenal job. And this year, we've seen an incredible response to feeding the pipeline. I started as a town meeting member. I then became a selectman. I then lost in my first race statewide. But I stayed the course and mentored other women along that road. It's all so much with women about mentoring and giving people the sense that they can do it, that they can hold their nose and jump off the high dive, mm-hmm. which is not an easy thing for women to do. And I take that role seriously. And I feel like it's a mission and a responsibility of mine to not just do my job, but to use my job as an opportunity to expand the playing field for all women. And but again, it's not easy. And right. we are combating cultural biases in this country, and it hasn't gotten easier. It's gotten worse.
Well, the good news is, and this is based on learning organizationally, especially with Shannon Jenkins, who's the chair of political science at UMass Dartmouth and specializes in this area, is that when women run, they win. That's the good news, is that women are compared to comparable men running, that's not to say they don't face different hurdles and expectations, absolutely, and work much harder to win, but they win. Women don't run anywhere near as much as men, and there's research that shows that women need, on average, to be asked 7 times before they'll say, yes, I'll run. So one of the things that help is, as the treasurer said, mentorship, but cohort programs that support women going through together, and all our listeners, ask the women that you think should be leaders to run.
Ask more often.
And
right?
ask 7 times, yeah.
Erin, what are your thoughts on the importance of having more women leaders in the public and private sector? Do you think this will be necessary to create economic stability for women and families?
Well, I think, as Treasurer Goldberg said, there's a number of studies now that are very, rigorous studies, which demonstrate that organizations that have greater diversity in their leadership positions have better outcomes. They have a higher profit. They just do better. And I think that what that speaks to is the need for diverse perspectives, the need for diverse experiences, that when you have a variety of perspectives at the table, you get a more rich discussion, a better dialogue, and a different potentially outcome than you would otherwise. So I think the data are clear on that point.
Yeah. The Office of Economic Empowerment is hosting a series of empowerment workshops for women, and the next one will be in New Bedford on December 6th. Treasurer Goldberg, briefly tell us a bit more about what the workshops are about.
The workshops are part of our overall programming that we do throughout Treasury, and I've mentioned a couple of the programs prior to that, but basically it focuses entirely on women, and it focuses on savings, retirement, banking, and also a wage negotiation workshop. We know from longitudinal data that we've done pre and post programming that this works. And I'm going to tell you something. As you can well imagine, being up in the State House and having my nose to the grindstone can at times be challenging and tough. I received a letter one day on a particularly tough day from a young woman who had attended our workshop. She was in a very bad place before she went to it. Her mom had just died. She was in a relatively low-paying job, even though she was a college graduate. But, of course, she had her college loans that she was paying down. She was living in a rental apartment, but really felt that she was not getting any equity from paying rent. And what she said to me in that letter was how this program changed her life. It brought tears to my eyes. She said it has empowered her to have the self-confidence to go in and negotiate for a higher wage. It gave her the confidence to sit down at a bank and figure out how to save money, how to think about retirement, how to figure out when she can afford to buy a condo. And she even began looking at a condo and then made a bid on one, but it went up too high. There was a bid, and so she pulled back rather than being caught up in trying to overbid someone else looking to buy it. And not only that, but she signed up for more programs that would support her own learning around the financial skills she needed to survive. That didn't just make my day; it made my month. So these programs that we're doing are life changing.
For more information on the December 6th workshop, the Office of Economic Empowerment, Pew Charitable Trust, and the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts, go to our website, capeandislands.org. State Treasurer Deb Goldberg, Valerie Bastet, Executive Director of the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts, and Erin Currier, Director of the Financial Security and Mobility Project at Pew Charitable Trust. Thank you all for joining us this morning.
And thank you for having us.
It was a pleasure.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.